Welcome back, everyone. It's a great pleasure to have Mohamed Khalil with us today. So he's a finishing PhD student at the University of Maryland, working with Alessandro Buonanno, but he is mostly based at the Max Planck Institute for Gravitational Physics in Potsdam, Germany, these days. And so he'll talk about dynamics of spinning compact binaries. And so it's a great pleasure to have you, Mohamed. Please take it away from here. And by the way, I should mention, Mohamed is fine with anyone asking questions at any time, so please simply feel free to jump in at any point if you have questions or comments. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for the introduction and for the invitation. I'm going to discuss how to obtain post-Newtonian results valid for arbitrary mass ratios from self-force results at first-order mass ratio. And I focus on the dynamics with spinning compact binaries. As you know, gravitational waveform models are very important in gravitational wave physics. Gravitational waves are usually quite noisy, and to be able to extract the signal from this noise, we need to do matched filtering between the signal and a gravitational waveform. And once we detect a signal, we need to use accurate waveform models to estimate the parameters of the binary. And the more accurate those waveform models are and the more physics we encode into them, the more we can learn about the properties of the system. For example, by improving the spin description in waveform models, we can get better estimates for the spin magnitude and the spin tilt in spinning systems, which helps in identifying the formation channels. For example, the spin distributions for binaries formed by dynamic capture is different from the distribution for binaries formed by common envelope, for example. The most accurate waveform models are from numerical relativity, but since numerical relativity simulations are computationally expensive, and waveform templates need something order hundreds of thousands of waveforms, it's important to have accurate analytical waveform models. So we use there are several analytical approximation methods that are often used for the binary. The post-Newtonian approximation is valid for the low velocities and weak gravitational potential. It's most applicable for comparable mass binaries in bound orbits. And by comparable mass here, I mean something mass ratio up to 10, but even up to 100 is considered comparable mass. And this is the main source of gravitational waves for ground-based detectors. The post-Minkowskian approximation is an expansion in GM over R. So it's an expansion in the weak field, but for arbitrary velocities. It's most applicable for scattering motion because in principle, the velocity can be arbitrary. So as long as the separation is not too small, this is a good approximation to use in this case. The gravitational self-force is used in the small mass ratio approximation, where the mass ratio of an emery, an extreme mass ratio in spiral, can be of order 10 to the fifth or more than 10 to the fifth. In that case, the small body stays close to the big black hole much longer than a comparable mass binary. So if we use a post-Newtonian approximation, we would get a large accumulated phase error. So it's important to use self-force in this case. It's also possible to combine all these approximation methods to obtain post-Newtonian results valid for arbitrary mass ratios from self-force results at first order in the mass ratio by using the scattering angle in the post-Minkowskian approximation. The scattering angle has a very simple mass dependence in the post-Minkowskian approximation that can be used to relate it to the just by using it, we can relate the post-Newtonian expansion to a self-force, a small mass ratio expansion. This is sometimes called the Tutti-Frutti method because it combines different approximation methods in one approach, just like Tutti-Frutti ice cream contains many different fruits. Tibu Damur called it that method, and it called, it's now used in papers as the TF method. So now this method was developed by Bini Damur and Giralico and has been used to derive almost all of 5PN except for two coefficients at second order in the nest ratio and almost all of 6PN except for four coefficients. In this talk, I'll describe, I'll give an overview of that method and discuss where the mass dependence of the scattering angle comes from, and discuss work we did on calculating the spin orbit dynamics at 4.5 PN in these papers, which is the third subleading PN order, and an extension in this paper to the fifth and a half post-Newtonian order. In this paper, we also calculated the spin one, spin two dynamics at third subleading PN order, which is 5 PN. And I'll also discuss the spin squared dynamic. This is ongoing work, which has implications on the first law of binary mechanics when we include the spin quadruple. This table is from Justin Vines, and it includes all the known PN orders at each order in spin. This is no spin, starts at Newtonian order. Spin orbit starts at 1.5 PN order beyond the Newtonian. Spin squared starts at 2 PN, and so on. And the leading orders are all linear in G. They are of order, they are first order in post-Minkowski. So, and if we have the post-Minkowski expansion, we would need 1 PM to obtain the leading orders, 2 PM next to leading orders, and so on. The orders written in black here were derived at least independently by two groups using two different methods, while the terms in blue were only derived by using one approach. The terms in gray here are only partially known. They're still missing a few coefficients, or in the case of spin squared and higher, they are known for aligned spins only. The Tucci-Ferrucci method was used to obtain all these results. So the full next to leading spin orbit term, 4.5 PN, 5.5 PN minus one coefficient, 5 and 6 PN as minus a few coefficients. And these can be obtained from first order cell force results for aligned spins. As an overview of the Tucci-Ferrucci method, the conservative dynamics is split into non-local and local in time contributions, where the non-local contributions, those are due to radiation emitted at earlier times and scattered off space-time curvature back onto the binary, which affects their conservative dynamics. And it starts at 4 PN order for zero spin and 5.5 PN for spin orbit. This is given by an integral over the energy flux, as I discussed, and that integral is calculated analytically in an eccentricity expansion. For bound orbits, we use a small eccentricity expansion, while for unbound motion, like a scattering, we use a large eccentricity expansion. The non-local contribution, we calculate it by relating the Hamiltonian coefficients to the scattering angle coefficients. Because of the very simple mass dependence of the scattering angle, this significantly reduces the number of unknowns in the Hamiltonian. We can then relate the Hamiltonian to the redshift and spin precession frequency. Those are invariant quantities that are often calculated that can be calculated from cell force. And we can, by relating the small mass ratio expansion of the redshift and spin precession calculated from the Hamiltonian, by relating those to cell force, we can determine the unknowns in the Hamiltonian. For the non-local part, the non-local contribution to the action is given by this time integral. This is the local time, And at each local time t, there is a contribution from all from the radiation emitted at all earlier times t prime, and it's an integral over this this time symmetric or time split gravitational wave energy flux. The gravitational wave energy flux is given in terms of source moments, but the time symmetric version is we just use t prime instead of t here. And here, this is a Partifini operation to remove the divergence at t equals t prime. And this is a length, an arbitrary length scale s. And this integral gives us the non-local contribution to the Hamiltonian. Superscript leading order, but here I mean the leading, we only need here the leading order at non-spinning and spin, the leading order for zero spin and spin orbit. So we only need the leading order in the mass quadrupole and current quadrupoles, and that gives us the leading order in the Hamiltonian, which is 4 pn for zero spin and 5.5 pn for spin orbit. And that's because this is c to the c cubed, and this is 1 over c to the fifth. So that's 4 pn for zero spin. And spin orbit is 1.5 pn order beyond the leading. So that's 5.5 pn. Damourian, Yaranovsky, and Schaefer showed that this integral can be written in terms as this integral in terms of tau defined as t prime minus t. Plus a contribution, this is a local contribution that only depends on local time t and contains a dependence on log r over s. To simplify the local part of the Hamiltonian, we choose this arbitrary length scale to be r, the harmonic coordinate r, which removes this log term. And evaluating this integral can be done analytically by using the quasi-Keplerian parameterization, expressing the source moments in terms of the eccentricity and semi-major axis and time, integrating, taking the Partifini operation and an orbit average gives us an expression like this. This is the leading order spin orbit contribution to the non-local Hamiltonian. It depends on logarithms and Euler gamma. These transcendental numbers only appear in the non-local part of the Hamiltonian. As a convenient gauge, we use the EOB Hamiltonian. We relate this harmonic coordinate non-local result to an effective one-body Hamiltonian, just as a convenient way of doing the calculation, because the Hamiltonian is much simpler. The EOB Hamiltonian is much simpler to work with. In an EOB approach, the dynamics of a binary of masses M1 and M2 are mapped to the dynamics of a test mass of whose mass is the reduced mass of the binary in a deformed background, in a deformed Schwarzschild or a Kerr background, whose total mass, the mass of the black hole is M1 plus M2. And we can also map, if this is a Kerr black hole, we can also map the two spins. We can map the Kerr spin to the sum of the two spins. This effective Hamiltonian is the Hamiltonian either of Schwarzschild or Kerr. And we encode the PN results in the potentials of that Hamiltonian. The spin orbit part of the effective Hamiltonian can be written as the dot product of the angular momentum and spin vectors. These are some combinations of the spins. And here, these are the gyro gravito magnetic factors, which only depend on R and PR. We choose a gauge such that they only depend on PR, but not on the angular moment. From this, we see that at spin orbit level, the only coupling between spin, so at spin orbit level, spin only couples to the angular momentum vector with no other dependence of the Hamiltonian on spin. So once we...
Sorry, may I ask a question here?
Yeah, of course.
So I guess here you are assuming alliance spins, is that right?
Well, I was getting to this. So this Hamiltonian is for precessing spins. For precessing spins,
for the EOB, right? So you have A equals to A1 plus A2. So that's for line spin?
Even for precessing spins, we can still use this map as the vector A equals the vector A1 plus A2.
Is there any reason behind that?
It's not really needed. It doesn't really matter because for precessing spins, the curved spin is the magnitude is still A1 plus A2. Yes, here is this is a vector or the magnitude doesn't really matter. What matters is how we encode the precessing spin information into the effective Hamiltonian. If we have if you want to encode the precessing PN information from the binary problem into the effective Hamiltonian, we would have dependencies like terms like N dot S. But if we only need aligned spins, we only have like things that the depend on spin magnitudes, not. It's the same map, but just different dependence of the effective Hamiltonian on the spins. At spin orbit, this doesn't matter. For either aligned or precessing spins, it's L either times or dot S. And these gyro-Lebesgue magnetic factors are the same.
Okay, thanks.
To simplify things, I'll work just with aligned spins. But once we determine those gyro factors, that gives us the precessing case. And to obtain the non-local part of those gyro factors, we write them in terms of unknown coefficients in a PR expansion and calculate the orbit average of that EOB Hamiltonian in terms of eccentricity and match it to the harmonic coordinate non-local Hamiltonian. This way you can determine the coefficients of the non-local EOB Hamiltonian, and it's much simpler than the harmonic coordinate Hamiltonian. Then to determine the local part of the Hamiltonian, we use the mass dependence of the scattering angle or the impulse. So in a scattering process like this, the scattering angle is the angle that the body is deflected when it scatters. And this is the impact parameter, the distance between the two world lines at infinity. Damour showed in this paper that the magnitude of the impulse has this very simple mass dependence. So the impulse is the net change of momentum, and its magnitude depends on the mass at 1 pm. We only have m1 and m2. And at each pm order, we have an extra power of the mass. So each pm order is a homogeneous polynomial in the two masses. And these are only functions of energy. There's no dependence on the mass in these coefficients. In this paper, we showed that the same mass dependence holds when we include spin. We just need to introduce, instead of a dependence only of the energy, we also need a dependence on the spin divided by the impact parameter. Here, the spin is the spin divided by the mass. This is a mass rescaled spin, which has dimension of length, so that this is dimensionless. The same mass dependence holds for spin. The impulse can then be related to the scattering angle. So in a scattering process like this, momentum is conserved, so the magnitude of momentum before scattering is the same as after. So sine half the scattering angle, this angle, is half the magnitude of the impulse, which is so q over 2, divided by the length of that vector, which is in the center of mass frame, p1 is minus p2, is the center of mass momentum. which from relativistic kinematics can be expressed in terms of energy. Right. So, and this gamma here is asymptotic Lorentz factor. It's defined as the dot product of the two forward velocities. And we can write it in terms of the relative asymptotic velocity. And we can also show that this equals the effective energy, the dimensionless effective energy that is used in the EOB energy map. So, and the energy is given by this EOB map. This means that when we divide here by M1, M2 over energy, that the scattering angle scaled by E over M1, M2 has the same mass dependence as Q, or that the scattering angle scaled by energy per total mass has the same mass dependence as Q divided by the reduced mass. So the scattering angle is given by this, the same mass dependence, except that instead of this M1, M2, we'd have the total mass. We can then write the mass, the scattering angle, in terms of the mass ratio, because any homogeneous polynomial in M1 and M2 of degree n can be written in term as a polynomial in the symmetric mass ratio, which is defined as the reduced mass over the total mass of degree n over 2, and we take the floor of that number. So for example, at 3 pm, we have a quadratic polynomial in the two masses. And because of the symmetry under exchange of the two bodies labels, this coefficient, which is a function of energy, is the same as this. So we can write this expression as something linear in the symmetric mass ratio. And here this is m, total mass squared. At 4 p.m., we can do the same, and it's still linear in the symmetric mass ratio. At the 2 p.m. orders below this, it doesn't depend on symmetric mass, and at 5 and 6 p.m., it's quadratic in the mass. So this allows us to write the scattering angle scaled by the energy like this. At 3 and 4 p.m., it's linear, and 5 and 6 p.m., it's quadratic. When we include spin, we also get a dependence on the anti-symmetric mass ratio, which is M2 minus M1 divided by the total mass. And that's because this is, for example, the polynomial that multiplies A1. This coefficient is different from that coefficient, which means that we need to, when we rewrite it in terms of mass ratio, we'd get this term that depends on the anti-symmetric mass ratio. And the same at 4 p.m., we get something like this that depends on delta, delta nu and delta. This is still linear in the mass ratio, because in the test body limit, delta is either 1 or minus 1. So we can still obtain this from first order self force results. This is done by relating the local Hamiltonian to a local. We calculate the scattering angle from the local Hamiltonian and relate the scattering angle to a scattering angle, and that's written to satisfy that mass dependence. So the scattering angle is calculated from the Hamiltonian by inverting the Hamiltonian to obtain PR as a function of energy, angular momentum, and R. Differentiate and integrate from minus infinity to infinity to obtain the scattering angle as a function of energy and angular momentum, which we can then rewrite in terms of velocity and impact parameter. We then match that scattering angle to the scattering angle ansatz to relate the Hamiltonian coefficients to the scattering angle coefficients. Here I wrote only the terms that depend on the mass ratio as in terms of unknowns, and replaced the terms independent of the mass ratio like this with the results for a spinning test for the results for the scattering angle of a spinning test mass in a curved background that were obtained in this paper. So once we obtain this term from the results of a test scattering angle, this gives us, this is 1 PM and at leading PN order. So this gives us the leading PN spin orbit order in the Hamiltonian. And once we know the leading PN order in the Hamiltonian, that gives us the leading PN order in the scattering angle at all orders in the in G. The same here. Once we obtain this term, we get the next leading PN order of the Hamiltonian, which gives us all the V cubed terms at higher PM orders. The first unknown coefficient we get is the dimension of the mass ratio appears at 3.5 PN, and it's the only unknown at that order that requires a first order self force results. At 4.5 PN, we have three unknowns, all linear in the mass ratio. And at 5.5 PN, we have six unknowns, all linear except this coefficient, which is quadratic. So everything else we can determine from self force. We do that by using the first law of binary mechanics, written here for eccentric orbits, aligned spins to linear order in spin. This is radial frequency, radial action, orbital frequency, angular momentum. This is the redshift, which can be calculated from the Hamiltonian by differentiating it with respect to the mass. And we take an orbit average of this to obtain a gauge invariant quantity. And this is the spin precession frequency, which is the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the spin. And again, we take an orbit average. I'll discuss in a few slides where this first law comes from, but for now we can use it to relate the Hamiltonian to the redshift and spin precession invariants.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what does it mean to have, you know, like an orbital frequency in a scattering scenario? Like we are just considering scattering, not bounded orbits.
Oh yeah. So this is, here use the scattering only to relate the Hamiltonian coefficients to the scattering angle coefficients. Once we do that, we use the Hamiltonian, which is for bound orbits, to obtain bound orbit results. This is all now for bound orbits, not for scattering.
I see. Thank you.
After calculating the redshift and spin precession from the Hamiltonian, we express them in terms of gauge invariant variables, like the orbital frequency and the periastron advance, expand in the mass ratio to first order, and then express them in terms of the Kerr geodesic variables, eccentricity and inverse similarity spectrum, which are the variables often used to express self-force results for the redshift and spin precession. Those were calculated in self-force literature by many people in many papers to high PN orders. These dots represent some PN expansion. When we calculate the redshift from the Hamiltonian and compare it with self-force, a good check of the calculation for both the local and non-local calculation is that all the logarithms and Euler gamma functions should cancel between self-force and the PN calculation. That's because those only appear in the non-local Hamiltonian, which we determined separately, and the local Hamiltonian only depends on some rational numbers and pi squared. And from self-force results, as there are three orders in eccentricity are known at linear order in the Kerr spin. This A here, I'll use A as the background Kerr spin and S as the spin of the small body. This is only known for circular orbits. The spin precession is known to second order in the eccentricity.
So in post-Newtonian theory, the definition for eccentricity is not unique. There are different kinds of eccentricities. So
yes.
What is this eccentricity here?
Here we use the eccentricity defined as in the Keplerian parameterization, which agrees with the eccentricity definition used in self-course when expressed in terms of characteristic variables.
Okay.
So, yeah, so we write those invariants in terms of frequency and pre-astronaut advance, then expand, and then relate to the variables used in self-course.
So it's defined using the pericenter and apocenter distance?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So
you also have a question here.
Yeah.
Sorry. So you said that the scattering scenario will be taking eccentricity to be very large. So like, can you see that from here, like your periastronaut bands would be just infinity?
Well,
or,
we only
and also the redshift. Like, what does it mean? Like, if you take this eccentricity to be very large.
Well, here we calculate the redshift and spin precession for bound orbits and expand in small eccentricity. Assume eccentricity is small and expand in eccentricity. So
you cannot re-expand this in large eccentricity. You will have to do it from the beginning.
No. For bound orbits, everything here, all the calculations here are for bound orbits, except when we relate the Hamiltonian to the scattering angle. And here we only
but you mentioned that you could go to the scattering scenario just by taking the eccentricity to infinity. So you just expect that you do that expansion, then you recover everything for the scattering.
Here I said that to obtain the non-local contributions for unbound motion, we need to use this large eccentricity expansion. I'm not discussing it here because in the end we need something for bound orbits. So we only need to expand the non-local part in small eccentricity, and the local part we obtain it without an eccentricity expansion. We only use small eccentricity expansion when we relate the redshift to self-force results because they are calculated in an eccentricity expansion. But the local result is valid for both bound and scattering. There is no eccentricity expansion in the local Hamiltonian. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay, so to see how the known self-force results are enough to solve for the unknowns in the scattering angle, we take a look again at the scattering angle ansatz in terms of unknown coefficients. And here, this is A1, which is the small, we take as the small spin. A1 becomes S. So this when we differentiate the Hamiltonian with respect to the small spin, we obtain the spin precession frequency, which means that the spin precision frequency depends on this coefficient, the sum of these two coefficients, and the sum of these two coefficients, like this. But the redshift, the term linear in the Kerr spin, this comes from A2, the spin of the large body. So this redshift would depend on this coefficient. And since A2 is given by the same expression, we just replace A1 by A2 and delta to minus delta. This means that the redshift at linear order in A depends on the difference between these two coefficients and the difference between these two. So we can use the three orders in eccentricity known from the redshift to solve for this variable and one of each pair of these two variables. And then use the two eccentricities known from the spin precession to solve for the other two coefficients. At lower orders, we have more constraints from self-force than unknowns. So this can be used as a check of the calculation. And yeah, so this is enough to solve for all the unknowns in the scattering angle except for this. And this is the result for the scattering angle. This remaining unknown at second order in the mass ratio, we find that it has a small contribution to the dynamics by comparing the binding energy to numerical relativity. So here, the binding energy, we can extract the spin orbit contribution to the binding energy by combining two configurations with aligned or anti-aligned spins, which removes the non-spinning and spin squared terms in the energy. And this is the spin orbit contribution to the energy at leading order up to the 4.5 pn, which is the third subleading order. And we see that as we include higher orders, we get closer to the numerical relativity curve here. This plot doesn't show the 5.5 pn curve because it's very close to the 4.5. But we can hear in this plot, we take the difference between the binding energy calculated from EOB and NR. And this is 3.5 pn. 4.5 pn is a significant improvement, but 5.5 is a very small improvement. Here I took, for the solid curve, I took that remaining unknown to be zero. But since it's expected to be of order 100 based on the other coefficients in the scattering angle at that order, here I varied that remaining unknown between 500, between minus 500 and 500. And we see that it's still smaller than the difference between the lower orders. So it has a smaller effect on the dynamics. Okay, next, so far I explained the calculation when working with Hamiltonian. It's possible to do the same calculation by working with a radial action instead of a Hamiltonian. So the radial action is a gauge invariant quantity that can be calculated using this integral over a bound orbit. And an analogous quantity for scattering, this radial action is for bound orbits. An analogous quantity is can be obtained by integrating PR from minus infinity to infinity. We can call this the unbound radial action, or the unbound, this unbound or the scattering radial action. And the scattering angle is related to it by just a derivative with respect to angular momentum. And by analytic continuation, one can show that the bound radial action is related to the unbound radial action by this relation where we only flip the sign of the angular momentum and the spins. This was a similar relation was derived in this paper by Kellen and Porto, where they showed that the pre-astron advance is related to the scattering angle by this relation, where we also flip the sign of angular momentum and spin. And this was generalized to any observable in this paper. So if a bound observable is expressed in terms of an integral over a bound orbit of some function f, and an unbound observable is given by an integral from minus infinity to infinity of the same function, those r min and r max, those are obtained from the roots of PR, and for bound motion, the two roots are positive. But for unbound motion, only one root is positive, and it's the same as the bound case, but the other is negative. But if we flip the sign of angular momentum, we get the same root as the bound case. So these papers used the relation between relations like this between the unbound and bound case to show that any bound observable can be found from the unbound one. By this relation, we just flip that sign, and the theta function is either plus one if that function is odd in angular momentum, or minus one if it's even. So for example, if we take that F to be PR, PR is even in angular momentum, it's L squared, depends on L squared. So this theta becomes minus, so we get that minus sign, and we obtain this relation between the bound radial action and unbound radial action. The same for separate estimate events. Now, moving to spin one, spin two, the calculation is very similar. It's even simpler because we only have one coefficient at 4pn and two at 5pn. We can relate them to spin precision, and we only need two constraints from NR to determine those remaining unknowns. We can compare the binding energy. Spin one, spin two contributions can be isolated by combining four configurations with different spin directions. And here we see that each PN order gets us closer to the numerical relativity error. This shaded region indicates the numerical relativity error, but that's a very conservative estimate for that error, which is likely much less than this. So we hope that this means that our new 5PN term improves over 4PN. Now, moving the spin squared.
I have so many questions, sorry. So how do you determine like this kind of like observable for instantaneous, you know, like the instantaneous evolution? Like, you know, if you go from scattering to bound, like, you know, this analytic continuation is like, you know, the scattering, you go compute state scattering angle, you know, when times come from minus infinity to plus infinity. Mm-hmm. And then in the bounded scenario, it's just, you know, interpret as, you know, integration over one orbital period. Mm-hmm. But how do you get like the time evolution of those, you know, observable, like, you know, like instantaneous from this, you know, analytic continuation?
You mean the time dependence in the binding energy, like these plots or in...
For instance, yeah.
Well, in these plots, those are done only for assuming exact circular orbits while neglecting radiation reaction. And yeah, so there is no time evolution here. We just calculate the energy, which is the Hamiltonian minus the total mass at quasi-circular orbits with different radii. We calculate it numerically from the EUB Hamiltonian, obtain this.
Yeah, like that's like saying, you know, you're sort of integrating this like over a period, like an orbital period or something like that, right? But then if you want to get like, you know, the instantaneous quantity, can you do that from the analytic continuation?
No, well here, everything I'm doing is assuming conservative dynamics. So there is no radiation reaction. And yeah, in that case, we don't need to take the time dependence of the spiral into account. We just assume conservative dynamics. Does that answer your question? Maybe I'm not understanding it.
No, I think it sort of does. I'm just thinking how exactly, but yeah, we can chat later.
Yes, sir. So for spin squared, there is one unknown at 4pn and three unknowns at 5pn. However, the unknown self-force results are not enough to solve for these three unknowns. Because even though we have three orders in eccentricity, they depend on the difference between these two coefficients. So they cannot be used to solve for the three coefficients independently. What we need is the spin precession frequency at linear order in the small spin. Because then this A1 squared becomes S in the spin precession, and we get the dependence on the sum of these coefficients. But this is something we are working on calculating with Chris Kavanagh and Josh Matthews. And once we determine this, we'll get this remaining coefficient in the spin precession frequency from self-force, and once we know it, we plug it here to obtain the aligned spin squared part of the Hamiltonian or the scattering angle. The spin squared part of the redshift has been recently calculated in this paper. However, for circular orbits, however, it's not enough to solve for it. We can't relate it to these coefficients because only the quadrupolar part of spin appears in the redshift. And I'll discuss that in a moment. But first, to see why the redshift at spin squared is different from linear in spin, we first take a look at the first law for at linear order in spin. And here I'm summarizing the arguments in these papers. So if we assume that the Lagrangian depends on a set of dynamical variables and some constants, we then vary the Lagrangian with respect to those constants. Here, by constant, I mean something like the mass or spin magnitude. So we vary the Lagrangian with respect to those constants and the dynamical variables, and take those dynamical variables on shell so that to satisfy their equations of motion so that this is zero. And then if we perform a transformation from x to x prime, so this gives us that term, and this again on shell, this term is zero, and same here. So we end up with this, just this term, the same as this one, plus some total time derivatives. So this means that if we have two Lagrangians, L and prime, so the only difference would be a total time derivative, and if we take an appropriate time average to remove that total time derivative, this means that the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to any constant is a gauge invariant quantity. And because the Hamiltonian is just pq dot minus L, and so it's the kinematic quantity minus the Lagrangian, this means that the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to that constant equals the derivative of the minus the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to that same constant. This can be used to obtain the redshift. So the Lagrangian can be written as a mass times the action can be written as a mass times integral of d tau dt. And this is the definition of the redshift. So if this is the only explicit dependence of the action on the mass, this means that the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the mass gives us the redshift of the minus, which is the same as the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the mass. The precession frequency follows from the equation of motion for the spin. And so S dot is a precession frequency cross S. And this is the definition, but this is defined as the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the spin vector, the magnitude of this, the average magnitude of that is the precession frequency, which can then be obtained from the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the spin magnitude, which is constant, and which means that this is gauge invariant. We can also express the Hamiltonian in terms of action variables, in which case the angle variables are constants, and we can write the redshift and spin precession as derivatives of the Hamiltonian without needing to do an orbit average. So these derivatives gives us the first law to linear order in spin. So a crucial assumption here is that this is the only dependence of the action on the mass. However, we know that at spin quadrupole, we have another dependence in the mass. This is the spin quadrupole. This is the non-minimal part of the action for spin quadrupole. This is the spin quadrupole constant. And this is the electric component of the Riemann tensor. So if we want to preserve the identification of the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the mass as the redshift, this means that we need to absorb this mass into that coefficient. This coefficient is 1 for black holes. It's normalized to 1. But for the neutron stars, it depends on their mass, spin, or equation of state, and usually varies between 2 to 4. So we can define a constant, let's call it Q, to be as that spin quadrupole constant times the spin magnitude squared divided by the mass. And I'll mention in a moment why we include a spin squared here. But if we do this, then the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the mass can then be identified as the redshift. To see what the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to this constant Q is, we consider a line spin case, write the spin vector as spin magnitude times the spin direction, and define the eigenvalues of the 3x3 matrix formed from this tensor as written. So we define these eigenvalues, lambda 1 and lambda 2, and since that electric quadrupole tensor is traceless, this is the same. The third component is minus the sum of the two. So the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to Q gives us this times the spins. So the spins for aligned spins would pick the 2-2 component of that tensor, which gives us this eigenvalue of the electric component of the ring. With that, we get this version for the first law with spin quadrupole. We keep this constant is the depends on the spin quadrupole constant, spin squared, and the mass. And this gives us an eigenvalue of the electric component of beam. This version of the first law agrees with all known results from cell force for the redshift spin precession and tidal invariance. So for the redshift, this was calculated at order spin squared in this paper. And if we calculate the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to M1 while holding Q constant, we get exactly the same term they obtained from cell force here. For spin precession invariant, we include spin squared here, so that when we hold this term constant and differentiate the Hamiltonian with respect to spin, we obtain the spin precession, which here I calculated for a test spin. And the expansion of this agrees with what you will get from the Hamiltonian. Now, the eigenvalue of the electric quadrupole tensor is often calculated from cell force to some high PN order. And we can relate it to this eigenvalue just by the ratio M2 squared over total mass squared. And by calculating the Hamiltonian, we get this, which agrees exactly with the cell force result. So this was more of a justification for that form of the first law rather than a derivation for it. But if we assume that this is true, we can write a conjecture for that first law to all multipolar spin orders. So the spin-induced part of the action can be written as a sum like this to all orders in spin. These constants are all normalized to 1 for black holes. So we can define a multipolar constant as this C divided by the mass times the spin, the magnitude of the spin, some power. And then the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to that constant would give us something that relates to here I'm assuming aligned spins. So this would give us one of the eigenvalues of that tensor. And we don't have much to compare with cell force here, but what we can compare is the eigenvalue of the octopolar tensor, which is calculated from the dual of Riemann and covariant derivative. And this agrees with one of the eigenvalues calculated from cell force for those octopolar invariants in this paper. there are only two terms. This comes from the spin cubed in the Hamiltonian. This comes from spin to the first, like A1 times A2 cubed in the Hamiltonian. And those terms agree with the cell force results. So hopefully this is a good conjecture for the first at higher orders in spin. So these are my conclusions. I'll just mention some future work that remains to be done. So far, there is still one missing coefficient in the spin orbit part at 5.5 pn. That coefficient can be calculated using targeted pn calculations. For example, in this paper, they showed that how to relate the two missing coefficients at 5 pn to three coefficients that can be calculated in an effective field theory approach. So something like that could be done for a spin. Or it can be calculated from second order cell force results. There were recent results at second order, numerical results for the binding energy and for the flux and the modes. So, and I know that Chris Kavanagh is working on analytical second order cell force calculations. So hopefully this is something we can obtain in the near future. But until then, we can use those new results in effective one-body waveform models. And we are currently including them in the next version of EOB that is planned to be used in LIGO's O4 run. And complement the missing coefficients with NR calibration. To complete the spin squared part, contribution to the Hamiltonian for aligned spins, we need to calculate the first order cell force spin precession frequency to linear order in spin for circular orbits. And that's something we're working on. And we need to derive a rigorous, to get a rigorous derivation for the first low spin quadruple. And that's something Paul Rameau and Alex Lochak are working on. They already published the paper on the motion of a multipolar particle. And finally, we want to investigate how to obtain precessing spin results using cell force, because the impulse should have a similar mass dependence for precessing spins as well. So it should be possible to relate them to the first order cell force results. And that's it. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Mohamed, for a great talk. It was already quite a bit of discussion, but maybe there are additional questions or comments that people have. So Will, I see Will has a hand up.
Thanks, Mel, for the very nice talk. So I just had kind of a bigger picture question. So I guess here, your kind of strategy is to combine all these different perturbation theory calculations and try to get a very accurate analytical waveform that way. So can you say a little bit about how the accuracy of the waveform models you're able to attain right now compared to ones that try to like incorporate some kind of, you know, fitting to numeric relativity, like, you know, EOB, where you include some analytic information, fitting to numeric relativity, or even like surrogate waveforms where they basically input very little physics, and then maybe in the coming years, how you hope to, or where you hope to be in terms of the relative accuracy?
Well, here we see that the improving the PN orders does improve agreement with NR. Here, this was only assuming conservative dynamics with no calibration in the EOB Hamiltonian. And in general, before doing any calibration with EOB, we want the Hamiltonian to be as close as possible to numerical relativity results. And that way, it would be easier when doing calibration to obtain a more accurate model. I can't say exactly how these improvements in PN directly directly correspond to an improvement in a waveform model, because there are a lot of components in a waveform model, especially EOB, where you have the Hamiltonian flux modes, calibration, and so on. But this is a good indication that it is making some improvement. And the initial results we are working on now indicate that this might be the case even when we include the radiation reaction and modes and so on. We still find an improvement. But how will this translate when we include calibration to NR? I don't know yet. For surrogate models, those only calibrate numerical relativity directly, so they obtain a waveform without Hamiltonian. And of course, they are more, in general, they are more accurate to UB because they are directly in R fit. The issue is that you can trust them in the range where you calibrate it to NR and maybe extrapolate beyond that range. But in regions of parameter space where you don't have numerical relativity simulation, especially for eccentricity and precessing spins, the EOB has an advantage in that case, I think.
Yeah, thank you.
Any more questions?
Maybe I can ask a question following Will's question. So we know that for, let's say, third generation detectors, the requirement on the waveform is extremely high.
Yeah.
Probably we need to improve several orders of magnitude in terms of accuracy.
Yeah.
So can you imagine, like, to achieve that the goal for accuracy, like, for example, how do you do it? Or for example, in terms of the perturbation order, like how many PM orders you need to get, or like how does the future waveform construction work? Like, do you still need to do some kind of hybrid of numerical relativity and this analytical modeling, or can you just tell us what do you expect to get such a high accuracy waveform model?
Well, so for third generation detectors, we need something like three orders of magnitude improvement in accuracy. I don't know how that can be achieved, but what we are working on now is one order improvement in accuracy, so that the EOB models work with LIGO's, the next run of LIGO 04. And for that, in addition to the PN, including more physics, like PN, higher PN orders in the Hamiltonian, something like horizon absorption, for example, in the flux, higher PN, in addition to higher PN orders and so on, and of course, better calibration. So to go beyond that for third generation detectors, I don't know. We probably need to combine PN results with self-force and find better ways of incorporating numerical relativity with it. And hopefully by then we would have numerical relativity would cover larger regions of parameter space, so we can do better calibration of the model. Yeah. But I don't have a good answer for what's more than an order of magnitude at most.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Any final questions or thoughts? Okay. Well, if not, let's thank Mohamed again for a wonderful talk. And thank you all for attending. See you all next week, same time, same place. Thank you.